On this episode of the London Lyceum, Morgan Bird and Daniel Lee talk about public theology. So they cover all sorts of topics related to Christianity and its relationship to the public square. How should our faith interact in the public sphere? Is there any value at all in unity and in diversity? What's the difference between renewal and transformation? How might our faith have outworkings in different spheres in our own communities, whether it's in our work or in our local areas? How should we allow the biblical storyline to propel us in our own mission wherever we're at? And much, much more. As always, if you have thoughts about the episode or ideas or requests for the show in general, hit us up on Twitter or Facebook or check us out at our website, thelondonlyceum.com. Now for the only analytic, Baptist, and confessional podcast on the planet, we think this one's going to get you thinking.
Well, I'd like to welcome all of our listeners to another episode of the London Lyceum, where we are a podcast that's dedicated to serious thinking for a serious church. My name is Morgan Bird, and I'm the Confessional Theology Director here at the London Lyceum. And week in and week out, we like to have different guests on the podcast to discuss different things. We like different people from different backgrounds who will challenge us to think and help us develop a kind of a culture of Christian virtue. We like to pursue certain values and virtues, things like charity, curiosity, critical thinking, and cheerful confessionalism. We are interested in learning. We want to grow. We believe that the church ought to think, and the church ought to think well. And so today I'm really excited because we're going to be interviewing a new guest, Daniel J. Lee. Daniel is the director of New City Fellows Program at the Center for Public Christianity. Daniel and I have known each other for a few years now, and he's a good friend of mine and a very smart man. He's married to Crystal. He lives in Raleigh area of North Carolina. He did his undergrad at Stony Brook and then got a master's at the Westminster Theological Seminary. And I'm really excited to bring you guys to Daniel and to the Center for Public Christianity. Daniel, thanks for coming on today, man.
Thanks so much for having me, Morgan. Really excited to be on this.
Daniel, I'd love for our listeners to just get a quick tidbit, maybe just a 2 or 3 minutes on kind of your background, your upbringing, maybe even, you know, how you came to faith in Christ, and then what initially got you interested in this topic of public theology.
Yeah, happy to share that. So my background is I'm Korean American. I was born here in the States. And I'd really say that my kind of journey, my professional journey, my ministry journey has really grown out of my personal upbringing. My father, he was a church planter from South Korea who moved here to go to grad school, seminary eventually, and then also to he planted a church in the Korean immigrant community in New York, and that's really where I grew up. And I think it's it was really in that context of growing up in New York City as a Christian and also as a minority, a person of color, the child of an immigrant, that I really started thinking about culture and Christianity and in so many different ways, how the two interact. Culture in the sense of kind of ethnic culture, but also kind of Western culture and how, my own kind of search for understanding my identity and also, who I am and where I live and what God is calling me to be and to do in the world. I think that's really where the search started for understanding really the world around me from a Christian perspective. I grew up going to public school and in New York City, public school, middle school, I started to realize that it was pretty difficult to reconcile my childhood faith, the way that my parents had raised me and what they had taught me, what the Bible taught, with the culture around me, with the world around me. And this realization only grew over time as I got older, went to college, and then I started working. And this is, true for a lot of people today, especially if you go to public school, you hear one thing at church or from your parents, and then you hear another thing at school and or your friends around you. And even if you don't go to public school, you'll hear it in the world and culture around you on the internet and friends and whatnot. But So this was true not only in terms of lifestyle, the way people lived, I saw a tension between the way people lived and, you know, Christian kind of morals or values and virtues, but also in terms of worldviews and belief systems, people, the basic beliefs that people have about the world around them, what is true and what's not. And so on the one hand, New York is, highly secularized. And yet it's also incredibly diverse and relativistic. I guess the diversity is just there. It's from all the different people who live there, so many different cultures. And yet kind of the reigning, at least at the time, kind of paradigm for understanding how that diversity and pluralism, should kind of coexist and live together was kind of a secularized and pretty relativistic kind of worldview that said, we have all these people who live together with different beliefs, so many different religions, and yet kind of the reigning paradigm was an atheism when it came to how to kind of bring all those pieces together. So most of my teachers growing up were either atheistic or nominally or culturally Roman Catholic or Jewish. Very few Protestants, very few evangelicals, really outside of the few churches that I knew of. And so I heard a lot of views that critiqued traditional religion and theism in general, but Christianity in particular growing up. And so I was always kind of living at the crossroads, living within the kind of the cross pressures, if you will, of these different views. And so my father was a conservative evangelical pastor, Korean American, but he was also heavily influenced in his own childhood in Korea by Baptist and then charismatic American missionaries. And for instance, he was very impacted by Billy Graham's ministry and crusades in Korea and throughout the world. And so, he was very aware of how typically conservative, confessional American Christians responded to the secularization of American culture and of the West, with concern. And he exemplified, I would say, the kind of responses that, that American Christians have to these cultural changes, desire for evangelism and revival, church planting, that kind of thing on the one hand, but also on the other hand, kind of politics and political action and, the sort that gave rise to the Christian right and the moral majority. And so, I was, this is kind of the way that I was raised and the kinds of responses to culture I saw exemplified around me. And so it was this really kind of, a jarring and very cross pressurized, to use Charles Taylor's language. I felt the pressures of kind of religious faith, Christian faith, faith in the gospel and Jesus Christ, with, being at odds with the world around me. And I was felt a little bit out of place. And a New Yorker who's, a faithful Christian was just something I really wrestled with. And so for me, my own kind of faith journey, it really was about, a personal faith in Jesus Christ. But I knew the implications of what that meant for, your worldview and your belief systems and also the way you lived. And so I spent a lot of my college years and also the years afterwards really trying to reconcile these pressures, learning more about theology and then, but not just theology, not just what a Christian ought to believe because of what the Bible teaches, but how that interacts now with the world around us and people who believe differently and think differently and religions that speak differently. And so I would say that was the setting for my interest in public theology, apologetics, and just a theology of culture in general, which is really what my work involves now. I think that kind of sums up the background that gives a way to my professional journey.
Yeah, so I'm curious from a personal standpoint, that cross pressure that you felt and that you kind of almost talked about, like if something was building up, was mm-hmm. that something that you have, like, would you say now that's something that you feel like Christians have to learn to live with, or was there something that you then came into contact with or some kind of way of viewing the world or interacting with the culture around you that that relieves some of that pressure, or that sort of undid the valve, the pressure valve, if you will. I'm right. curious how you would talk about that.
Yeah, that's interesting. I never really thought about the other half of the metaphor of the pressure and needing release and a valve. But, that's a really good question. Do Christians need to learn how to live with that? Well, I think one way of thinking about it is, yes, Christians do. But the other side of it is all people do. We are all living in a pluralistic world where we hear different things and we believe different things and hold to different values that we don't realize come from different places, different worldviews. You know, we're not all consistent, and we're all kind of working through our beliefs. You know, even the most devout Christian, you know, our own sin, for instance, sin and grace, you know, how the two live at pressure in the life of a Christian is, you know, you can see how this pressure exists, even from that perspective. But from a kind of a cultural and worldview perspective, yeah, we're all kind of living in with some sense of fragility, to use another Charles Taylor term, about our we feel fragile in our faith or in our basic convictions, because we're always hearing from different perspectives and challenged our basic beliefs are. How I found some relief or release, I think so for me, I started to think about questions of whether the Bible was even true, whether Christianity was, it was the true or the truest religion, if you will, that Jesus Christ was the way and the truth and the life. The exclusivity of Christianity. I started wrestling with that in college, because of a lot of what I heard from professors and classmates and friends. And people would say things, make claims about the Bible all the time. And, I think this was around the time that the Da Vinci Code was written or was popular. And so you heard lots of things said about the Bible and the fact that it was not, true or reliable, and that there are all these other texts and religious traditions. And so I had to wrestle with it. And, that's where I kind of started reading a little bit more, apologetically, for instance, The Case for Christ, and just understanding basic kind of the background for how the Bible was formed and the canon was formed or recognized, and how the manuscripts underlying the biblical text were handed down faithfully over generations. And so I started thinking about it from that perspective, from a worldview perspective, kind of the logic behind different worldviews, and delved a little bit into that. I would say the biggest thing for me really, though, was walking into Redeemer Presbyterian Church, where Tim Keller was the senior pastor at the time. It wasn't his writing ministry hadn't really even started at the time. So he wasn't nationally known except among pastors and kind of seminary circles. But I didn't know what I was walking into. Actually, it's funny. A lot of my the youth kind of group, the members of our youth group at my father's church growing up, would graduate and go off to college when I was a youngster, and they would go off to a church called Redeemer Presbyterian Church, and many of them never came back. And so I had this weird whole thing against Redeemer Presbyterian Church, even though I didn't know what it was doing, even though I didn't know who Tim Keller was. I just knew that it was kind of the church where a lot of college students went and disappeared to. I didn't know why. And it was only when I started attending that I really understood why. I started going when towards the end of college, where I just needed something for myself. I was very involved with several different ministries, including my at my father's church. And I just needed a service and a kind of a place where I could just worship and learn and grow on my own without having kind of ministry responsibilities. And so I started attending because they had a night service, pretty soon into attending, I realized why people love the church so much, because of what the church was doing in the city. And also I would later recognize in light of, or in the setting, in the context of this our very secularized society, and how the gospel was being proclaimed as true and good and beautiful, and people were coming to Christ, and there were conversions, and yet it was still very much a church that was seeking the good of the city, living within the city faithfully, and trying to live at peace and love their neighbor really in a significant way in the midst of New York City. And if you recall those two kind of approaches that that I mentioned before, you know, the evangelism and politics kind of approach that a lot of evangelicals take to our broader culture. I guess with the evangelism piece, like one example of this that I saw growing up was I would see missionaries, for example, from a different state who would come to Raleigh or who come to New York City, and who would preach the gospel, and on a street corner, let's say Union Square, and then they would they would preach, and a crowd would gather, but then at the end of the weekend, they would go, back to, whichever church or state they came from. And that would be it. That would be their mission trip to New York, in other places, I would hear about things, New York being referenced as kind of a, kind of this post-Christian, very secularized, maybe sometimes even compared to Sodom and Gomorrah, that kind of modern equivalent of that kind of, a sinful and godless city. And so that was kind of the approach to evangelism I saw growing up. And then there was the political side as well, right? But what Redeemer did was they said, no, we're Christians. We believe in scripture. We believe in the Bible. We're Orthodox in our faith, but we're going to live in the city. We're not just going to, do our mission trips here and then kind of escape to a more comfortable, more safe place for Christians. Look, we're going to actually live in the midst of the city and be neighbors and serve and seek the common good, seek the welfare of the city that we were in, and truly be New Yorkers and yet Christians at the same time. And that was kind of something that it was a category I had never seen before. And I was like, wow, this is like, these are people who are doing this. And of course, the preaching was really life-changing for me and formative for me. And in helping me realize that, a Christian could live in the modern world. You'll still feel the pressures, and you'll still have questions and doubts about faith, and you'll deal with them all the time, with people around you. But it's actually possible to be a Christian in the modern world, and to be a faithful one at that, and also a loving and charitable neighbor to those around you.
Outstanding. So I know you're talking a lot about your time in New York, but I know you don't live in New York anymore. Now you live in Raleigh, and you serve at the Center for Public Christianity. And I'm assuming that what the work you're doing now, since you're kind of sharing with us this mm-hmm. background and kind of how it influenced you, must touch now on something that you do now for your work. And so I would love to hear just a little bit about what the Center for Public Christianity is. So where is it that you serve? What is it that you're doing? Mm-hmm. And then how does that relate to some of what you've just been telling us with regard to your time at Redeemer City and Tim Keller and that sort of thing? So a little bit about the Center for Public Christianity. Mm-hmm. And then, where did the center come from, and what are you guys about?
Yeah, so the Center for Public Christianity is a ministry based in Raleigh, North Carolina, that's serving essentially Raleigh and the Triangle area. And so it's a very localized ministry. Really, it grew out of New City Fellows, which is the program of the center that I direct. So New City Fellows was launched about 8 years ago. It was started by a church here in partnership with other churches, the main church being Holy Trinity Anglican Church, whose rector at the time and now is Reverend Dr. John Yates III. John is the son of John Yates II, who was the rector of Falls Church Anglican for a long time. So this church was started by an Anglican congregation, an evangelical Anglican congregation that wanted to serve the city, and really to do a lot of what Redeemer City to City was doing in New York City, but in Raleigh, and to become a place that to create a center of ministry that would serve all the churches in the city, and also bring churches together, Christians together in common cause and mission as we try to reach the city and and serve it together. So New City Fellows is a fellowship program that it's a discipleship and fellowship program for young professionals, mid-20s to roughly 40, mid-40s. And not just professionals, but also emerging leaders. That includes people, you know, in vocational ministry, but also, you know, full-time parents, people who really want deep discipleship in the gospel and in the Christian tradition. Kind of in I would say it's an ecumenical ministry, so it is a kind of a mere Christianity approach to the faith and to Christian history and to doctrine. We do glean from lots of different traditions and denominations, and we, you know, so we're not just this kind of like amorphous Christianity, but we are we're kind of a big tent, broadly evangelical and broadly kind of reformational or reformed, if you, in that broad sense. And, but we, you know, we want to interact with Christians across the city and disciple them for service in their church and in their workplace and in the marketplace, all throughout the triangle. So the founder of this, of New City Fellows, the founding director, was Catherine Alsdorf, who co-wrote Every Good Endeavor with Tim Keller. That's a book about kind of a foundational book on faith and work ministry. And she was hired by the group of folks here, starting with Holy Trinity Anglican Church, who really wanted a discipleship program to disciple the next generation of leaders to really live out the gospel in their generation, in our generation, for the life of the city, and to be a winsome and faithful witness to the gospel in our city, and to do that across churches. And So she was hired out of retirement after she had retired from starting and running the Center for Faith and Work at Redeemer for a number of years. And so in 2016, she came down to start that. I was hired in 2018, and I served as a program coordinator for the center. And then also now I am, I've been leading the Fellows program as director for a year now, going into my second year. Now the center was created out of the New City Fellows program, as a way to run other initiatives that would bring pastors together of churches. Really, New City Fellows, it's our target audience is lay leaders in the city. So the center is kind of meant to bring churches together institutionally outside of the Fellows program, but also to, you know, let's say if we wanted to have a common conversation on what it means to be a faithful Christian in the world of tech, we could have something for people, you know, of all ages and across churches in the area. So now how my background fits into all of this, how it plays into it, I think, you know, it really is a natural kind of growth. My role at in the Fellows program is a natural growth from outgrowth of my own kind of background, my own theological and spiritual journey, and also my ministry path. I was part of a church plant in New Jersey. And then I was also, when I first moved down to Raleigh, I was at the Summit. I was working with a lot of young professionals on discipleship and faithful Christian witness in our world today, in culture and at work. And I think my big interests are in this area of, I would say, applied public theology, how Christians live faithfully and winsomely as witnesses to the gospel and followers of Christ in the world, making sense of the world around them, but also a faith, you know, in light of modern questions and things that they experience. And so, I really bring all that experience and also my own kind of research interests to bear in my work.
This may seem like an overly simplistic question, but I it feels like, you know, you've already described that because of your upbringing, you noticed that there were different approaches that someone could take, right, yeah, to the kind of the culture at large. Like there's not a one size fits all, or there's not one option available. Mm-hmm. But I guess a more fundamental question then to get at what kind of posture or what kind of approach we're going to take would be to ask, why should a Christian care at all about thinking about their faith in a public way like this, you know, like, you know, we could all just have our piety and just kind of hang out and try to be holy in a kind of our own personal lives. What is it about the public space or the public sphere, whether it's through where I work or where I play or where I shop or who I vote for? I mean, why should Christians care about our faith in the public space?
Yeah, that's a great question. It is, in a way, the reason of existence for the center, helping people answer that question. Now, I think that there are a few different answers to that. At the heart of, I mean, one place I like to start is with Leslie Newbegin's article, or how he described the Christian faith as inherently a public faith because of the historicity of the resurrection of Christ. If Jesus Christ rose from the dead in real history, as Christians claim he did, as the New Testament attests, and as the church throughout history has, borne witness to, if he did rise from the dead in real history, that means something for the world. The Christian faith is inherently a public faith. It is making a claim about the world out there, not just the world within the walls of the church or within the heart or the mind of a Christian, a follower of Christ, but it's saying something about the world out there. And so right from the bat, the Christianity is a public faith. That's the first, I guess, entryway into thinking about how faith relates to the public square. But I also think there's another way of another thing that needs to be answered about what we mean by public. So when people talk about Christianity and the public, they think typically about kind of public apologetics, maybe like public proclamation of the gospel, and then that meeting, objections to the gospel or to Christian faith, and then addressing those kind of publicly. That's one way of thinking about it. Another way is also thinking about it in terms of politics, or the realm of public common life that leads to political deliberation and negotiation and action. That's, kind of what we mean by the public square. But I think there's a whole realm of life and the world that is public, but aren't just arenas of evangelism and apologetics on the one hand, and politics on the other. It's all of life. It's the rest of life. It's culture, and I think that's what Christians often miss, is that God wants us to live out our faith in the world, right? And this is where I think I think we'll get into this in a little bit, but the tradition of Neo-Calvinism, or it's kind of a movement within a tradition within Christianity that has really thought about how the confession that Christ is King, that He is Lord over the world, and that He has established His kind of end times lordship, His final lordship over the world through His life, death, and resurrection, how that confession leads us now to live in the world under His lordship. And that's not just within the church. That's also not just in politics. It's all of life. So how we work, how we our neighbors, how we live in the sphere of civil society, if you will, how we live in our cities and communities, all of that is a part of our discipleship, our worship, our witness to Christ as Savior and as Lord. And so all of that is implicated in our bare confession of Christ as Lord. And so, those are two starting points, I would say, that drive us toward thinking about and living out our faith in public.
So you just mentioned the resurrection of mm-hmm. Jesus and the lordship of Jesus as two doctrines or piece of theology that kind of you're trying to apply to life. You're trying to bring those to bear into sort of modern everyday cultural life in the 21st century. I guess maybe kind of in a more broader sense, mm-hmm. as you guys are working maybe with the fellows or with these different events or things that you're doing in general at the Center for Public Christianity, is there kind of an overarching narrative that you're trying to get your fellows to kind of wrap their heart around, or wrap their mind around, so that they can then go back into the world? You know, is there sort of a a biblical theological story, or is there, are there certain kind of key fundamental aspects of the biblical storyline that, that you feel like if they can get this, if they can grasp the movement mm-hmm. of the Bible in this particular kind of way, or, mm-hmm. Or like you've mentioned, if they can grasp these couple aspects of theology or doctrine, then it's going to transform how they view the world. But is there kind of a kind of some key objectives or key, key handles that you're trying to give your fellows that, that would, that, that you feel like would change how they interact in their everyday lives?
Oh yeah. There, so we love talking about the biblical storyline. I think that, yeah, the best way of thinking about biblical worldview is to start with the biblical storyline. Storyline gives way to worldview. It is, we think about, you know, our basic beliefs about reality in terms of story, where we came from, where we're going, the purpose of things, if we believe in one, right? If our basic belief system provides us with a telos. And so, yeah, for Christians, and the way I disciple in the program, we really lean into the biblical storyline, and we think about the kind of the broad contours of it. I think, you know, it's been well summarized in kind of that the neo-Calvinist or the tradition that comes out of Abraham Kuyper and Hermann Bavinck and Gerhardus Voss, where we think about the biblical storyline in terms of creation, fall, redemption, and restoration, or some people will say consummation or new creation. But yeah, we really help Christians think about the implications of that world, of that storyline for life. So if it's creation, fall, redemption, restoration. And I think, yeah, there are so many ways that each of those chapters of the biblical storyline or kind of layers of a Christian worldview, there's implications for each of them. And there are so many ways that I think a faulty view of the faith or of life or of the world in general come out of missing an aspect of creation, fall, redemption, or restoration. So, for example, creation, taking creation seriously and taking the goodness of creation seriously and of all of life and our kind of vocation, our creational vocation in the world that God gave Adam and Eve and all humanity in the garden and in creating us as imago Dei, as his image bearers to represent him, to steward his creation, to make culture out of his creation. I think that those are kind of along the lines of what we help people see. This is what human beings were created for. We were created by God. This is our calling and a basic thing that we will do, even if we're not following the Lord, even if we don't confess Christ as King or follow Scripture. Human beings will create culture, and we will do something with God's creation, whether or not we are, you know, we mean to or not, you know, whether or not we're doing it in a God glorifying way, where we are. And so we help, so I really try to help people see the beauty of creation, the goodness of it, and of the goodness of our calling to create culture and to do it in a way that glorifies God. So there's kind of creation, just a taste of what we talk about in the Fellows program. And then, but there's a reality of the fall, right? We think about, yeah, I mean, the fall is clearly evident around us. It's probably, I forget who said this, but there's that quote that basically says the fall is the only empirically, you know, provable doctrine of the faith, right? Like you see it all around you. And yet we have to balance the fall with creational goodness. We live in a good and yet fallen, a fallen and yet good world. And we see that at work. We see that in our families. We see that all around us. And we see that in current events. We see goodness and fallenness all around us. Sin, brokenness, suffering, death. We see that all around us. And so there's a fall. There's the antithesis, the kind of the alienation that human beings by birth have from God and from each other. And then, of course, there's redemption the arrival of Christ, and of course how it's been prophesied in Israel's story and in Abraham and his family, their story, and now how Christians are brought into that story of redemption. And then there's also consummation. What God will do in the future shows us what shows us his ultimate kind of plan for the world, right? And how that actually ties to his original plan for the world. So understanding those ties and how these four layers or chapters of story, of the biblical storyline kind of relate to each other, and how Christians today, followers of Christ, where we are situated within that story, it gives us, that gives us the meaning for life and for ministry and witness and all that we do. Like it's the meaning of all that we do and all, you know, of all of our lives is found in understanding how those four chapters come together and our identity in the midst of all that, our calling in the midst of all that. So that's kind of, this is typically what we talk about in the program, just in 5 minutes, but we spend, you know, several different units talking about these doctrines.
Nice. That sounds like really important work, and sounds like something that, you know, anybody could kind of process through and try to think out their life in these more, I guess, biblical categories, which would be helpful for any of us. Mm-hmm. Here's what I want to do. I think we, you know, with about, 10 or 15 minutes left, what I want to do is I kind of want to pepper through the values that are stated on your website. So I did a little investigation. I went on the Center for Public Christianity website and I pulled out these values, and I just want to ask a few questions, kind of pepper through. Doesn't have to be long answers, but I just want to kind of hear, you know, I'm always curious when organizations or ministries or even churches sometimes have values. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm kind of curious, like, you know, out of all the things in the world that you could choose, or all the things in the world that you could sort of post as your values, like why these? You don't necessarily have to make a defense for why these, but I would just like to hear a little bit about, like why y'all are putting the effort into to doing this work, mm-hmm. as expressed in these values. So the first value is the gospel, and you articulate, or the website articulates that as the good news of Jesus Christ as passed down through the apostles' writings and the historic global Christian church. And I know you mentioned this already, this kind of mere Christianity kind of approach, but why would it be important for organization like yours to have the gospel as kind of a central value to your work?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the first, you know, reason is that, you know, when we're looking for common ground for all the different churches and Christians across Raleigh, really what we, you know, what we want to, the flag we want to put in the ground is the gospel. I mean, there are different ways that Christians, you know, find a common cause with each other. And, you know, sometimes it's kind of a specific social agenda or a political or policy agenda, or it's, you know, specific aspect of our of mission, something like that, right? It could be, you know, overseas missions, you know, that's what brings a lot of denominations together, for example. But yeah, really, we start with the gospel because that's actually, at least in the world of that we live in today and the various churches that exist in Raleigh, you actually can't take that for granted anymore. You know, there are churches and Christians who don't really, they've lost the gospel, or they've kind of have a different version of the gospel. So I think clarifying what the gospel is and how it is the main thing that we want to start with our confession. The first thing we want to confess and believe is the gospel, and we want to unite around that. And I think that's why we start with it. I think, now, what the gospel, all the implications of the gospel and the other doctrines or values that might surround it, I think those are things that we work out together. But we start with the gospel.
So the next value is public faith. And I want to read like a short statement that you have there and get your thoughts on this. So it says that the gospel affects and redeems all of life. The gospel affects and redeems all of life. So here's my question. Should that be a controversial statement? Is that a controversial statement, and should it be a controversial statement?
Well, depends who you ask, probably. For a non-Christian, and we're not necessarily writing these values for non-Christians, but that the idea that all of life should be implicated in a religious faith, might be controversial. That's, you know, an obvious thing for a secularist, right? But yeah, the gospel affecting and redeeming all of life. I think also for a lot of Christians, they may not understand how the gospel affects and redeems all of life. There are some, you know, Christian traditions that might say, oh, the gospel or, you know, God's grace at work in the world is operative in the church, but in other realms, it's other kind of, you don't really, the gospel doesn't, you know, God doesn't relate to his, to the rest of the world in that particular way. He might relate to it in, you know, according to law or according to other kind of, you know, perspectives. So I think that this statement that the gospel affects all of life could be controversial even for Christians or something to kind of think about. But I think we start, the reason why we say this is because of what I was saying about the biblical storyline is that redemption or grace, the way it works in the world, what God is doing in the world with grace or with redemption through Jesus Christ, is he is redeeming and restoring his fallen creation. So creation, fall, redemption, restoration is, or those are the chapter headings. But if you summed it up in a single sentence, it would be that God is redeeming and restoring his fallen creation. In other words, grace is restoring nature. Grace is restoring nature. What we were, all of creation is what God is after in the end, in restoration and redemption. And so that's why the gospel affects and redeems all of life. And that's why, yeah, we think about the implications of all of that in for life today.
I can imagine somebody hearing your desire to say, for example, transform a city or something like this, and they may have a misunderstanding of what you mean by that at the center. Is there something you could say about what you don't mean by that? Like okay, when we talk about transforming a city or something like that. Here's what we mean and here's what we don't mean. Is there a statement you could make on clarifying for us exactly what that actually looks like or doesn't look like to transform a city?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So there is, you know, kind of a way that Christians describe neo-Calvinism, and neo-Calvinism, by the way, isn't the only tradition we glean from. We glean from many corners of the Christian tradition, including, you know, non-Calvinists. We're not really a particularly Calvinist in terms of soteriology or kind of ministry. We glean from them because of what they have championed for the church, or kind of the model that they've given for a lot of Christians to learn from regarding faith and culture and work. And so there, you know, often this tradition is called transformationalist. And you know, it's critiqued on certain grounds, like, for example, you know, I think there was a debate in the early 2010s that that this movement was a little too triumphalistic, or the language, sometimes people would talk about redeeming culture or redeeming a city, that language is a little too, you know, first of all, it's only God who redeems, it's only God who saves, right? That's kind of a basic tenet of the Reformation, right? And that only God ultimately saves and redeems. So we don't really redeem. And yet there's an insight there that we're called to transform a city, or I would say better word than transform is renew. And what I mean by renew is that we're called to bear witness to God's redemptive work and his renewing work in the world. One day he will complete in all of the world what he began with the body of Jesus at Easter. What God began to do with the body of Jesus at Easter is what he will complete in the final and general resurrection and the new heavens and new earth, right? And this that way of talking about things has, we've really learned a lot from N.T. Wright in his writings on this particular subject. And so that's why, you know, and I think this, you know, one way he frames it is we don't build the kingdom. We're not trying to build the kingdom here on earth. Christians aren't called to build the kingdom. Only God builds the kingdom. You know, or to use a different metaphor, only God can bring the growth. Only God can create real change in people's lives and in the city, in culture. And yet we're still called to do something. And the language that N.T. Wright uses is we build for the kingdom. So we're in a way mirroring or imaging God in not only in creation, but in redemption, in the ways that we interact with the world around us. So when we seek to address brokenness, for example, we We care for orphans and widows. We're addressing the fall. We're addressing brokenness and the fall by a work of love, right? We, for example, we care for orphans and widows, and that in a way is itself an image of what God has, a mirroring, a building for of what God will eventually do for all of creation. Right? Same with doctors, and this is where kind of the work and faith piece come in. Whenever we're dealing with fallenness and addressing fallenness in our work, we're in a sense kind of proleptically imaging what God will eventually do in new creation. And so that's what we mean by renew. It, none of this is final. None of this will even the best works that we do in serving our neighbors, in creating good culture, God glorifying culture, we know that it will not, last forever in the state that we created it into God's new world, right? Into the new creation. And yet we think that, I think that it actually lasts in some meaningful way, into God's future, into God's, the world that God has for us. And so as we image Christ, as we image, God, and mirror what he does, build for the kingdom, I think, that's meaningful work. That's meaningful participation in the world and in what God is doing in the world. And so that's why we use the language of renewal rather than transform.
That's good. That's helpful insights and clear distinction there. All right, your next value, work culture and the common good. I'm just curious, when most of your fellows show up, mm-hmm. do you feel like there's a lot of on-ramp to get them on board with even the idea that that their work or their life can be processed through a biblical lens or through this idea of renewal? Or do most show up already kind of assuming that that's a possibility? How do the fellows normally show up with regard to the idea of like their work or their participation in the common good?
Yeah. So, it's a great question. And we're about to have our orientation this Saturday with the new class of fellows. So this is good warm up for me, to get back into that, that mode of orienting them to our work. But yeah, I think there is definitely there's a gap there because most Christians are familiar with certain kind of categories or callings that Christians have, for instance, the Great Commission and evangelism, right? Or as I mentioned before, politics might be one way that you think about culture. And so when they think about work and culture and the common good, maybe work and culture, how to be a Christian at work and in culture, they're thinking about primarily when it comes to work, they're thinking about ethics and evangelism. Be a good worker, don't cheat, don't steal, be the best worker you can be. And then also evangelize, different Christians from different churches might have different approaches to evangelism, but they know that it's that's part of our calling. And so that's how they think about it. And same with culture, they might be thinking along the lines of culture war or culture, like maybe critiquing culture, this combative stance towards the culture around us. So we want to kind of help fill in what it means to connect faith, work, and culture. And part of that is thinking about the meaning of work. It's not like work itself. How does work itself, how is that involved in our discipleship? How is it, in other words, it's a whole question of vocation, our calling as human beings in God's world, and how work itself can be God glorifying. So we definitely teach a lot on that. And then same with culture. As I shared before, that way of thinking about the public, what the public is, we want to expand people's understanding of what culture and God glorifying culture is, and also the public square.
All right, I was happy to see that one of your values is churches and institutions, seeing that I'm a pastor of a local church. So I'm curious, why is it that the center exists? If God's bride, if the bride of Christ is the church, why would something like the center need to exist? And how is the center coming alongside churches in kind of the work of renewal?
Yeah, that's a great question. So churches we recognize that churches, the local church is the primary institution for Christians, that God has established for Christian community and discipleship. and the mission of the church at large. And so the church, you know, using J.D. Greer's language is God's plan A, right? The churches often, local churches often struggle to work together in common cause. And often they will do this within their denomination, which often isn't localized. It's a very kind of, it'll be like a denomination where you don't have many other churches in your denomination in the same city. And so really your work is kind of to build maybe an institute, like a seminary. You work together on, you know, on supporting a seminary and backing and raising up future, pastors and ministry, vocational ministry leaders for the church, or missions, overseas missions, right? Those are kind of two ways that denominations might work together. It's not really local work together. In order to reach a city, though, I think our conviction really is that you really need to bring churches together and churches across denominations and traditions, you know. Obviously, we're not just a wax nose when it comes to the essentials of faith. You know, we are Orthodox, and that's why we talk about the gospel as kind of as handed down by the apostles. But at the same time, we realize the need for Christians to kind of put secondary and tertiary, issues kind of on, relinquish their distinctives, but put them in the proper place when it comes to reaching a city together in common cause. And so that's what we try to do with churches. We're trying to raise up leaders for churches to do that together. So for example, right, some of the things that we do is one of the things that I've been doing is seeing how fellows alumni can lead in their own churches, continue discipling people in what they've learned at their local church. That's one thing that I've been trying to do. Another is to also, when it comes to other institutions, and this is kind of the second half of that value, churches and institutions, we're trying to raise up leaders to lead institutions. So much of our common life, as has been written extensively, is fraying because of a lack or the loss of trust in common institutions. And so we want Christians who will lead common institutions faithfully and for the common good. And so, for example, one of the things that I try to do is plug alumni into nonprofits, which often means that they will join the boards of nonprofits in the city, that they will be championing essentially the mission of the church through nonprofit ministries, through mercy and justice and evangelistic ministries in their cities, on the level of boards. And in that way, they can often act as kind of a liaison between their local church and nonprofits and missions organizations in their cities.
I think that's great. And I think in a way, some of what you've been saying leads to the final value of kingdom diversity. And I guess one of the questions I would have, I mean, I think diversity has been such a, interesting and important and controversial question over the last few years. But I would assume with something like the program that you're leading, you have to have people who are coming from different backgrounds, not only like we just were talking about, maybe some theological backgrounds, but even other kinds of different backgrounds. And so how do you guys address, championing this idea of diversity with people that are probably leaders, people who probably have convictions and values? Mm-hmm. Are there times when you've had to walk through some challenges in order to pursue that kind of unity or diversity? Not that you had to get specific, but just, what have you learned about walking through with different people, their differences, in order to pursue sort of a unity for the common good?
Yeah, great question. It is, controversial in depending on your context in which the word diversity is used. But when it comes to the mission of the center to reach a whole city, it's pretty important to recognize and live within and reflect upon and also reflect the diversity of your own city. You can't reach a whole city if you're not working with different people across the whole city. And that means, yeah, diversity has to be something to take into account and pursued, really. You want to be working with different Christian denominations or churches or communities and who are reaching different areas of the city. And the reason we put it up here, I mean, I think the first is that from, the perspective of many minority people, Christians of minority, often we look for that. We look for organizations that do value it because we know that, that it will be valued and that our voices will matter. Not so much, it's not all the time that, I go around looking for this particularly, but I do know that certain communities look for that in particular. And so if you want to engage them and it's not, some people might poo-poo it as like virtue signaling or whatever. It's not virtue signaling. It's signaling in the sense of a welcome mat. Like people should be welcome into this community, right? And people should be welcome to engage with it. And that's really what it is. It's not a virtue signaling in the kind of the flippant sense in which it's used. And so, that's why we have it up there. And really, I think at a city level, it's really important. In a local church, or if a specific church values its traditions and its specific distinctives and ways of living, even its culture, right? That's great. We want that to happen. And that's where, we want churches to be about, their distinctives. When it comes to reaching the whole city, though, that's where we kind of put the distinctives aside a little bit and say, all right, now let's reach across to people who are a little different from us so we can learn together, so we can live in fellowship in this kind of missional way link arms together to serve the whole city. And so, there's kind of a signaling purpose to this, but also a real, we want to reflect the kingdom, and it's really important to do that at a city level, even if it might be harder to do it at a congregational level. Hope that makes sense.
Yeah, outstanding. I appreciate you taking some time to talk with me today. I feel like these are things that every Christian and every church needs to be thinking through and wrestling with, and just kind of hearing your background and how God put you in certain situations in your life and then now has you in this specific role. It sounds like you're following the Lord and trying to live out your calling and to really seek the good of the place that God has put you and to raise up other leaders. I mean, I think every church wants to be about that business. And so thankful to get to hear more today about what you're doing and how you're doing it. If somebody wanted to hear more about the center, or if they're more interested in getting in touch with you or kind of connecting up with you, are there any ways they can do that?
Yeah, they can email the center at info@centerforpublicchristianity.org. And we also have an Instagram that we're most active, I would say, on Instagram. We have a website, centerforpublicchristianity.org. We'd love to hear from anyone who's interested in our work or wants to collaborate or think through things together. Really appreciated you having me on the program, Morgan. And really, really glad to share a little bit of my story.
All right. Well, this has been another episode of the London Lyceum. Thank you guys for listening and look forward to hearing if this one's had you thinking in some new and fresh ways.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.